I defy anyone listening to this tape now to walk into your bathroom, close the door, and spend just 2 days in it. Not 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years, and then tell me, come out and honestly preach, you feel that prisoners should be given longer sentences.
G'day.
Kirsty Melville here with The History Listen.
First, Grafton escapee Raymond Denning, who this week surfaced in the latest edition of Australian Playboy with an account of his first 2 weeks on the run.
In 1980, Raymond John Denning escaped from Grafton Prison in a rubbish bin.
The guts of the story is that he walked away from Grafton rather than ran, dressed in running gear and carrying a transistor radio and a bag of pepper for the tracker dogs.
Denning led a volatile life on the wrong side of the law.
You're just put in there to rot. They want to break your spirit, they want to break your mind.
There was the tragic death of his mother, abandonment, boys' homes, prison, prison escapes, and more prison. But he was just getting started.
Denning says that he was chased on foot by a police car before he managed to hide in the bush, burying himself in the dirt for 3 days while police walked all around him and helicopters flew overhead.
When an earlier prison escape went wrong and a warder died from his injuries, Denning got life.
When a prisoner eventually, his full time's up, they wonder why he cuts loose on society.
With nothing to lose, he's on the run again.
Denning says that he ate grass and lizards for the first 13 days on the run and he lost 3 stone in weight in the process.
This time, he has support and a political agenda. But old habits die hard. And in the end, Ray Denning would become the very thing he'd fought to stop. The ABC's Mike Williams picks up the story. In 1980...
Is it true that he was stopped by a police officer and asked what his name was? And he said his name was Ray?
I doubt it. It's in the Playboy story.
You don't reckon it happened?
No. I don't think virtually anything in that story happened.
Right, okay. Author and historian Mark Dappin thinks Denning probably just stole food and clothes from a nearby campsite. While police and Sydney's media combed the highways and byways of the Blue Mountains, they had no idea that Ray was hours away, probably drinking tea on the other side of the city. He had help.
There's very, very little precedent outside of the draft resistors for a prisoner escaping into a sort of organised radical underground. And that is what happened with Ray, at least for the first few months after the Grafton escape.
At least two prisoner rights groups were working to coordinate his safety.
And of course, there were a number of people who were prepared to put him up. One was...
Former academic and Labor MP Meredith Bergman was a prisoner rights activist with Women Behind Bars. She helped line up a place for Ray to hide.
And she was quite excited to have him stay.
Excited?
Yeah, she was a wonderful old lady. So the police are never going to find someone like that.
Meredith met Denning while he was on the run.
And I remember thinking, what a funny little fellow, because he's really not terribly... Well, he's not very imposing. He's quite short. He was very sort of deferential and polite.
Was he really that good looking? Everyone talks about his looks.
No, I don't. I thought he looked like a scared 18-year-old.
The old left. And right behind me here, a lot of people who've never demonstrated before. And one wonders how they're feeling at the moment.
So the anti-Vietnam War movement and the anti-conscription movement kind of taught a lot of people how to organise demonstrations, how to print leaflets, how to behave when you're arrested. And once Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War ended in 1972, activists felt emboldened and seasoned.
This was Meredith Bergman's story.
Vietnam was totally my conversion process, and I started getting involved, started getting arrested, and once you'd done that, a whole lot of other things just fell into place. I became involved with the anti-apartheid movement, Aboriginal land rights, the women's movement, of course, as it was beginning.
And also, prisoners.
It was almost a hunt for the most oppressed of the oppressed to champion.
Here's how Meredith saw it.
I've always thought that I should take action when things present themselves to you. And because so many of my friends were lawyers dealing with these dreadful things every day, I could see how terrible it was. And also I could see that there was a chance you could change these things.
Things like prison officers bashing inmates or closing the notorious and isolating intractable sections. By 1980, prisoner rights were already in the public consciousness. The Bathurst riots of the early 70s led to the Nagel Royal Commission in 76. The controversial high-security prison Katingal, known as the Electric Zoo, had opened and shut, but much was still unresolved.
The New South Wales Minister for Corrective Services, Mr. Hague, has described the situation in the state's prisons as explosive. Criminal charges against officers have been rejected.
What about the prisoners that were bashed? What about the recipients of the floggings? What happens to them? They're still rotten in prisons.
And it's raised the question again of the reopening of the maximum security block, Katingal.
Another former prisoner well known for activism, Brett Collins, is now apparently under threat of deportation to New Zealand.
Ray, look, Ray and I have such a long and beautiful history, beautiful history. He was my best friend without a doubt.
In the late 70s, Brett Collins shared his life with Ray. They grew close while they served time together in high security units within the New South Wales prison system.
One tooth was missing and he put his tongue through his tooth and go and laughed through that. Now it seems like such a simple gesture, but his whole face would light up. His ability to maintain his good humour and still have fight, it was amazing. It was quite special.
After the Royal Commission revealed widespread abuse by prison officers and Katingal was shut, Brett and Ray were shafted back to Grafton.
For us to be returned to the very jail, which was exposed as being the place of savagery, and to be held there was just amazing. And for Ray Denning himself, one of the key people who were the most hated in the system, for him to be there, it was outrageous, actually.
Denning was hated because he'd been given life for the bashing of prison warder Willie Carl Faber during a botched prison escape. Faber eventually died of those injuries. The New South Wales prison system would not forget. But Denning always denied he did it. He said he was verbaled by police.
I am starting to get depressed,
he wrote,
because I can't see the light at the end of the tunnel in regards to putting a stop to their cover-up. Help!
Verbaling was where police would make up a confession. Collins says he was verbaled for his crimes. It messed with him.
It meant that when I was convicted, I didn't feel as though I had to accept the responsibility for my behaviour because the police never proved the case. They just told lies. And so I found it even very hard a decade or two after I was released to even accept the fact that I did do the bank robbery for which I did get the 17 years.
Brett felt other side effects when he got out. The beatings and months of solitary confinement continued to have an impact long after he was released.
If somebody's close to you, they feel too close. It took me years to feel even just a little bit normal. And then initially when I came out, I was armed. I was armed all the time. I couldn't even conceive of not being armed.
You're scared?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. I felt constantly threatened by people around me, even though they're friends.
But Brett also gained something from prison. He learned he didn't have to let the law happen to him. He could be active. He could speak up for prisoner rights. And he did. And he gained a community. 40 years after he was released, he remains a leader within it.
I'm doing it because I love the prisoner community and I have a special role to play, and I'm playing it. And I'm playing it because I was given support. So there's a lot of love there.
So Brett was out of jail by the time Ray escaped in 1980, and he was keen to help. He was part of an activist group called Prisoner Action Group. They worked together with Women Behind Bars, and the group realised they had an opportunity. Ray's prison escape was a chance to use that media attention to help their cause.
Normally, the people that ring you in the middle of the night are the complete conspiracy theorists. I mean, the tinfoil hat wearing. We get a lot of those types of calls at 2 a.m, which is why when I got a phone call...
Raymond John Denning here.
I thought it was the Daily Mirror trying to... And so it took him a while to convince me that it was him.
Michael Robotham is a best-selling author. Back in the early 80s, he was a wide-eyed journalist working a red-eye shift when Ray Denning called and kept calling. Michael suspected Ray was an insomniac and lonely.
Guess you'd say a friendship developed. We talked about football, we talked about TV shows, we talked about movies.
Then one night, the conversation became more interesting.
And Ray said, get up to police headquarters. Get up there now. You've got to go now. So look at the front window. And we got up there and we found a letter. He'd walked up to police headquarters in New South Wales. I mean, senior police officers that are working there.
To find him.
You know, looking for him. And he'd walk right to their front door. And it's almost like he not just posted a letter, he put his hands and fingerprints on either side of the glass. It was a completely goading gesture. And one of the reasons that the police hated him so much was he made them look foolish so often.
My memory is that the press even got in on the sort of half excitement of the, oh, here's the new postcard from Ray Denning. I think they found that all, well, it was good copy.
I'm willing to be charged with the escape. All I want in return is all the prison officers proved to be bashers. I want them charged also.
The media attention was also a chance for Ray to continue his campaign against police verballing. Michael says at that time, the average punter wasn't interested in the issue.
The general public took the attitude, well, if he's a bad man anyway, then whatever it takes, you know, the police don't stitch up innocent men. There was only a relatively few lawyers and campaigning journalists that saw that this, if you allow a wedge like that to form, you know, it becomes, if the thin edge just opens up and there's broader corruption involved.
Michael makes the point that even if Denning did commit the crime against Faber, it didn't justify the way he was treated.
The relentless beatings. No one deserves that. Pretty much, I think their desire was, if we don't kill Ray Denning, we will push him to the point where he kills himself.
And he would. Or at least, that's what someone would like you to believe. Denning's political stunts continued.
He reviewed the movie Stir for Triple J, a prison movie.
Put him straight on all those lies he told about decent officers in the newspapers and on television.
And even recorded a new call sign for Triple J when it moved from Double J to Triple J.
I'd like to congratulate 2JJ on going FM, where they will be now known as 2JJJ.
While he was there, he asked listeners to demand a more powerful kilowattage so Triple J could have further reach.
So come on, gang, get together and write heaps of letters.
Thanks, Ray, and welcome, Sydney, to the first Prisoners program on Triple J FM.
People loved it. A lot of people did. They saw him as, yeah, I mean, Ray was sort of this Ned Kelly figure who was fighting against the establishment, fighting against sort of, you know, corruption. And that's the way I perceived he was, the narrative was going with a lot of people. People thought, wow, that's ballsy. That's ballsy, you know. Go, Ray, go.
A band called The Electric Fans released a song called Run, Ray, Run.
That it is only with your support will there ever be any sort of an inquiry.
As for Ray Denning himself, he's now gone multimedia in his campaign to wake up the public about his own case and the other issues.
He's such a fine fellow that, I mean, people who really know him respect him.
Well, I was there when he was being flogged. I saw it, I heard it. Hang in there, Ray, you know, like, I think you're doing the right thing, son.
Will only be through pressure that any justice or humanity will be brought back into this country.
The night came. On this bank of radios, we hear reports of shots being fired through the guard tower at Parramatta Jail. And, you know, I'm waiting for the photographer to come down from upstairs with his camera bag, and the phone rang, and a voice said, I want to claim responsibility for the shootings at Parramatta Jail.
This is the Reform Justice Devils.
And straight away it popped into my head. Well, I recognised the voice as well, but it popped into my RJD, Raymond John Denning. And I said, Is that you, Ray? Nah.
Nah.
Oh, come on, Ray. He got quite irate,
nah,
sort of
me.
Saying, it's not me. Not me, okay? It's a Reform
it's
Justice Devils.
It's not me.
It's
a Reform Justice Devils. And so that became a big story the next day. But that was the last time I ever heard from Ray.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it was necessarily a deeply considered tactical exercise with a strategic goal beyond the idea that his own case would get another hearing.
Former close friend, known only as Eddie, confirmed this was the case to Background Briefing in 1990.
Ray was not politically involved in anything other than Ray Denning's cases. He never campaigned for anyone's case, really, outside of his own area of self-interest.
The actions and Ray's public appearances die off. Why was that?
The police raided a safe house where Denning was living with a couple of women. Denning got out on a tip-off before the raid, and he essentially went back into the underworld with the only other people he knew. He drove a getaway car for a robbery, an armed robbery in Glebe, and contacted a bloke called Bernie Matthews.
Bernie Matthews served more time in Katingal than any other prisoner. When he got out, he formed a support hub for ex-prisoners. He appeared on the radio and was asked what he'd say to Ray.
Hang in there, Ray. You know, like, I think you're doing the right thing, sir.
But he could have told him that in person. Bernie was in touch. He helped him. He took Ray to a hippie commune where he most likely was given his first taste of drugs. Eventually, Denning ended up in Queensland, where he met up with none other than his old Katingal inmate buddy, Russell Cox. Cox was the only man to escape the extremely high-security prison, Katingal. Since then, he'd been Australia's number one wanted man, and for years, New South Wales police couldn't find him, not a trace, and yet Ray had no trouble tracking him down through the small network of professional criminals. Together, they pulled off the biggest payroll robbery in Queensland history to that date. Over 300 grand in just a few minutes.
The guards arrived, they took the money out of the security vans in cash tins. Denning and Cox, unmasked, simply walked up. One disarmed a guard and held him at gunpoint, and the other took the money. They both vanished. Denning purportedly blew more than $100,000 at the races subsequently, which again shows a man with no real plan.
Next time Cox and Denning meet to commit crime, one will betray whatever friendship their relationship held. For now, Denning makes his way back to New South Wales, and the police are tipped off. Denning was about to meet a woman named Linda Jobson. His extraordinary run comes to an end at a set of traffic lights.
Finally stopped in a car at Manly, ending his 16 months on the run.
With the recapture, I mean, it was sort of crashing back to earth. He realised basically that he was back in the nick. He wasn't going to get another chance to get out in a hurry.
So Denning returned to jail, and he remained a sort of political irritant to the prison authorities for a few months further. His son was born while he was in jail. But when he eventually came to trial, he had obviously made some kind of deal with the police.
The deal could have involved giving up a degree of activism in order to receive better treatment. Once he crossed that threshold of informing, there was no coming back.
Ray Denning, the author, is still Ray Denning, the prisoner, so he certainly won't be at the official book launching here at the Redfern Town Hall tonight.
As he sat, stirring in a Goulburn prison, a book was being launched. It was a collection of his writing titled The Ray Denning Diaries.
It's philosophical. It's very intimate, very personal and unselfconscious book because it wasn't written for publication.
But it is possible by the time a punter might have picked up that book, Denning's words would have rung hollow. Former friend, an inmate known as Eddie again.
Occasionally there'd be the sort of the bit of moon talk about escape or this, that or the other. and a little bit of sort of surface radicalism, but basically it was chasing the arm.
Were you shooting up with him at that time?
I've used a lot of restricted substances with Denning over many, many years.
The use of heroin was rising amongst New South Wales prisoners. The issue of if and how Denning abused that drug will become extremely relevant later in the story. Eddie also points out a growing bitterness between Denning and the activist groups that had helped him.
And I think they also recognised that intrinsically the person was self-centred and their support efforts were wasted there. Bearing in mind that he had a lady by the name of Doreen Bark constantly telling him that all of the radicals had abandoned him, all they wanted was a martyr for the cause, and now that you're arrested, you're no longer viable to them, which I must admit wasn't the case.
Who is Dot? Barks? Barks.
Bark.
Bark.
Bark, as in the composer.
Okay. Okay, so who is this person?
Dot Barks, so, like so much in this story, Dot Bark is a bit of a mystery. When she comes into Denning's life, she's running a service station in Yass with her husband, John.
She became one of Denning's pen pals.
When Dot starts writing to Ray, the service station is apparently going well. John and Dot are respected business owners in the Yass area. She writes to Ray that she knew him in another life and they were meant to be lovers.
His initial reaction to that was just hysterical laughter and, oh, yeah, this is a nice rat.
She sends him a picture, I think, of a cat on a bed.
And the first thing that came across was the money. And from then on, she owned Ray's ass.
It was probably Dot who first helped broker that deal between Ray and the police. Fast forward a bit, and the Yass service station falls into a financial hole. Through a prison connection via Denning, Dot and John Buck end up in Hong Kong to act as drug mules. They bungle the operation and get caught before they even pick up the goods. They're never charged for it.
At some stage, Dot and John become registered police informants and clearly have given information about very dangerous people to the cops, thereby putting in personal danger the guy who recruited them as mules, that being Denning.
Worried, Denning most likely informs again. He's transferred to another jail. Why does Ray stay in touch with Dot even after she's given him up?
Because Ray doesn't know she's given him up.
Ah. The web of informing gets tangled very quickly. Denning spends several more years behind bars. His public profile lingers, and he attracts more pen pals. A single mum, Margaret Ann Denton, helps line up a fake licence for his next breakout. It's 1988. Ray has jumped on the back of an escape plan from medium security prison, Goulburn. He's out again. He seeks out Russell Cox again, finds him again, and this time they're down south. In Victoria, an opportunity in the shape of a vehicle carrying cash presented itself to Denning and Cox, but the security van they were tailing took notice. They'd clocked the Queensland number plates.
It alerted the people driving the van that somebody was watching them, which is how the police came to be called, which is how Ken Ashworth came to be on the scene.
Can I just get you to say, just tell me your name and how you describe yourself?
Ken Ashworth, 62 years of age, overweight, yeah, still suffer PTSD, and yeah, I like riding my push bikes and getting out for a walk. That helps me, and probably drink too much.
This time around, you went a bit more personal.
Well, it's the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
If Ken Ashworth seems reflective, it's because he retired from Victoria Police just last year. 33 years ago, he was fresh on the beat.
On the Friday, the 22nd of July, 1988, I was with a surveillance crew and we're out near Doncaster on another job when a Brambles van pulls into the Doncaster shopping centre.
In the car tailing the van was Ray Denning, Ray Carrion, who he'd escaped Goulburn with, and single mother of three, Margaret Ann Denton.
Ann Denton was the sort of would-be recent girlfriend de facto, if you will, of Denning.
The cops come up with a plan to trap them. While they're waiting, they see someone in another car have a chat with Denning. They don't know who this is. When Denning makes a move, they box him in.
We met them nose to nose. I jump out.
Were you undercover?
Yeah. And I jumped out, ran round, jumped onto the bonnet of the car and covered them with the shotgun. As they sat there and they realised, oh shit.
Nowhere to go. The other car speeds off, but it'd soon be caught.
I've run round to the passenger's side and I could see that he's there and he's holding a 38 and I'm yelling, gun, gun. So I let another one rip from the shotgun through the side of the car, and with that he's basically slumped there. We didn't know who he was until a little bit later. He said, you'll be surprised who you've got.
Their lucky day. They'd stumbled onto the most wanted man in Australia, Russell Cox. Is it normal to take a photo with somebody you've just caught?
You're talking about the trophy shot, are you?
Yeah, I am talking about that shot. Yeah, it's a classic.
Back in the day it was, yes. It was a squad practice because we'd take Polaroid photos of the offenders we charged and we'd just keep them on in our collator's office as it was then. You wouldn't get away with it these days, but yeah, that was a trophy shot when you got Australia's Most Wanted.
Denning and Cox were locked up together in Jika Jika.
But really, they had nothing much to do but talk to each other. And eventually, Cox opened up to Denning about his life and crimes.
Their chat included a recent shooting at Berkeley Square, where the police had got the wrong man, resulting in chaos in the Melbourne underworld.
Once Denning realises he's got something to trade with police, he contacts New South Wales police, with whom he's clearly done a deal before. Eventually, he gets extradited to New South Wales. He's kept in the special purposes prison in Long Bay, the so-called Supergrass prison, and he makes a series of statements in which he implicates virtually the entire New South Wales underworld in one thing or another.
What prompted you to inform on another prisoner?
Well, I've never been one for sitting on the fence. I've always taken a stand on what I believe in.
He gives up Bernie Matthews, he gives up Billy Sutton, he gives up Brett Collins, he gives up Ann Denton, he gives up Ray Carrion, virtually every name mentioned in this story.
All his friends.
And I was 100% against authority and the system at one stage. And then I jerried that justice works for everybody, not just for the one side.
He tells them everything he knows about everybody's plans, starts to say, I've seen the light.
I was prepared to stand up and be counted and inform on other prisoners I believed had done the wrong thing, to give the victims a chance for once.
PS, can I have some reward money?
When somebody becomes an informer, obviously to the criminal world, this is one of the worst things you can do. But as a police officer, you must love it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. From what he had supplied, we were able to link a number of items back to Cox.
But not all of Denning's information was reliable.
There's been a dramatic increase in the use of prison informers. New South Wales jails are chock-a-block with them. There, 1 in 10 prisoners are on protection.
I often use the term representing a privatisation of the police verbal.
As public consciousness of police verbaling finally grew, a new type of verbaling took its place.
Juries are more reluctant to accept police evidence, and so increasingly the evidence of prisoner informants has been used as a substitute, if you like, for the police verbal.
As the police rely more and more heavily on criminal informers, the incentive to fabricate evidence grows.
In his early statements, he hadn't mentioned it, But then he remembered that Tim Anderson had confessed to him three times that he had planted the infamous Hilton bomb.
So much of this was about stitching people up.
Author and former journalist Michael Robotham.
You know, improving your crime statistics and whatnot. I mean, Ray had been a victim of that. He'd been a victim of police verbals and unsigned statements and brutality, and ultimately became a party to that very thing. He became the problem when he was fighting for a solution.
The Crims have had a pretty good run in the past. Sure, that we've had the verbal to contend with, but 99% of those cases, the Crim was guilty anyway.
He wants the Berkeley Square reward money, then he wants the Hilton bombing reward money, he wants WITSEC.
Witness protection.
But at the same time, he wants his sentence redetermined. There's a long, complicated kerfuffle, so it's a long time before any of the benefits that Denning might have expected or hoped for as an informer come his way. And by the time they do, by the time he finally does get out and does get WITSEC, it's clear that the information that he gave is not of the value that they hoped it would be.
Tim Anderson, do you resent the release of Raymond John Denning?
Let's not concentrate so much on the monkeys. Let's look at the organ grinder. The message that's getting through to people in jail is, tell on your mates, it doesn't matter whether you lie, you'll still get the rewards.
There are rumblings in the political establishment. Why have we given this guy witness protection for life, you know, a new identity for life, when he hasn't really given us anything?
Renowned criminal Raymond John Denning rolled over for the police and in the Sydney underworld was known as a dog. This gave him a lot of enemies.
His new identity lasts a couple of weeks and they take it away from him.
I've put my life in danger, I know that. I'm prepared to live with being called a dog. You know, I've got broad shoulders, so I can live with that. That doesn't worry me one iota.
And leave him essentially living in Paddington openly and having made an enemy of every heavy in the New South Wales underworld, virtually anyone who is illegally in possession of a gun might well consider it to their advantage to use it on Ray Denning.
1 month after his unannounced, unexplained removal from witness protection, he was found dead in an inner-city terrace house.
He dies of a heroin overdose in the arms of his girlfriend in Paddington. Everybody in the underworld and many people in the legal profession believe it was a hot shot.
What's your take on it?
Oh, look, I suspect he was bumped off. He had a target on him, there's no doubt about that.
And do you think that the police commissioner knew that the threat to Denning's life was unmistakable?
And no one would think otherwise.
The day before he died, Denning's family wrote to the state ombudsman. They complained about him losing witness protection. The ombudsman investigated and released a report.
This report is critical of the police and their decision to remove Denning from witness protection, and even critical of Police Commissioner Tony Lauer himself, because, quote, the threat to Denning's life was unmistakable.
In a poem, Ray described his life as an uphill battle. He died in 1993. He was just 42. Raymond Denning, Stitch Up, was produced by Mike Williams. The sound engineer was John Jacobs. Mark Dappin's book, Public Enemies, is published by Allen & Unwin. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I'll see you next time on The History Listen. Bye for now.